This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. After the Deepwater Horizon spill, BP poured nearly 2 million gallons of dispersants into the Gulf of Mexico. The goal, of course, is breaking up oil slicks, making them dissolve into ocean waters, sort of like how you squirt dish soap on a greasy frying pan to get the oil to wash away with the water. The problem is, after you dump all that soap into the Gulf, the soap stays there. My next guest has developed something that could be the solution, the soap that has iron in it so that you can suck up the soap with a magnet. How do they do it? And could we really use something like this next time there's a big oil spill? Julian Eastow is a professor in the School of Chemistry at the University of Bristol in the UK. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira.
Hey.
From the United Kingdom.
Thanks for joining. How did you get this idea? It sounds so simple yet so easy.
Well, to explain that, I'd like to propose an interactive experiment for you and your listeners. Would that be okay?
Absolutely.
Well, the experiment works best if you're in the kitchen. So go over to the fridge and take one of those picture fridge magnets. You know, with Niagara Falls, Las Vegas, or Disneyland on it.
Right.
Then now go over to the kitchen sink with the magnet. Next, put the magnet against the bottle of dish soap. Right. What happens?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. That's because normal soap is not magnetic. Just as you said, you can't control where it goes. Gravity does that, just sucks it down the drain. Now, Ira, we've been making soaps and surfactants with unusual properties for some years. Have you ever thought of a soap you could turn on with the flick of a switch? A light-sensitive surfactant. We made one of those about 5 years ago. And next we thought, why not try magnets? Would it be possible to make surfactants or soaps that respond to magnets? Well, if that's true, then you stand a chance to control where the soap does and where it doesn't go. Our motivation for this was just good old-fashioned scientific inquisitiveness.
So you created the soap that is magnetic so that the soap dissolves the grease, keeps the grease with it, and then you can just magnetize it away with a magnet.
Yeah, it sounds incredible, but it's true. I was witnessing the experiments in my laboratory at the University of Bristol this afternoon with graduate students. We were making emulsions with lube oil, our magnetic soap, and we were moving them around using magnets. The emulsions can be collected up.
And now I've got
amazing.
I got an experiment for you now. Tell me if this is possible. Let's say that you can put your soap, you can disperse your magnetic soap into a harbor. Can you magnetize the hulls of ships so that they sort of scoot around the harbor soaking up all the grease on collecting on their hulls, and then you just clean them off when they get back to the harbor?
Well, Ira, I haven't thought about that. It sounds feasible to me, but I think we would have to do some tests in the laboratory. I'm not sure about if you can maintain magnetism in the hull of a ship.
Uh-huh. But do you think you can do this with an oil spill by collecting up all the grease later on?
Well, in principle, that's right. That's what we've demonstrated in the laboratory. We started with chemicals that are relatives of common or garden soaps. We kept the organic part of the molecule, the one which dissolves oily substances, but we chemically modified the ionic part, which makes the compound water-soluble. And it's quite simple, really. We replaced the normal ions with magnetic ions. Those ions contain the element iron.
And voila, because the soap molecule, as you say, is fascinating to begin with. One end likes to stick in the grease, and one end likes to stick in the water, and that's why it works so well. And you basically
Yeah, sure.
took the water end and put a piece of iron in there.
Yeah, we've done this with iron. That's in the paper which has been published recently, but we've even used other magnetic units. I can't disclose them right now because they're under a secrecy agreement. But we are now starting to optimize the chemistry, and that is now really exciting. I think what this research shows is the first stage in any scientific breakthrough, the essential proof of principle. And once the proof of principle has been established and has been communicated to the scientific community, that's when it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
That's when the collective consciousness, those thousands and thousands of scientific minds, get to work coming up with ideas that you would never have thought of.
Yeah, it's so once you show that this can happen, and people will say, you know, this is what I could do with it. Sort of like...
Now, it was suggested to me, Ira, by somebody from the British equivalent of the Audubon Society. That's the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds in the United Kingdom. That this could potentially help in the cleanup of those poor seabirds when they get contaminated by oil slicks.
Oh, and they get washed down with this magnetic soap.
Yeah, he suggested that maybe with the extra pull from the magnet, you would be able to clean off the poor birds more effectively than just using the traditional, dispersants. So I sent a grad student down to the store to get some lube oil and a pillow. We've taken it apart, and we're testing that idea right now with down from the pillows that we bought in the store.
I'm sure the grad students are doing it, right?
Sure.
once these things happen, like you never know where they're going to end up. I mean, the laser beam was invented to cut steel and razor blades with back in the early 60s, but look what it's used for now. You never know where your idea might wind up, where we'll end.
No, that's the really exciting thing about being a scientist, is that you uncover facts and figures that you just do not know where that will lead for the human race. Think about the liquid crystals, which were developed in the UK in the 1970s. When they developed liquid crystals, they had no idea that it would be an integral part of mobile phones and smartphones, for example. But they certainly don't work without liquid crystals to allow you to interface with the electronics through the screen.
Now,
this is the same it could be here with this application, the applications that could come from this magnetic soap.
Now, let me ask you the $64 question, as we say here in the States. and it is a $64 question, I guess. Is it cheap enough? You know,
In fact, it's interesting that what we started with are chemicals that are just the brothers and sisters of those that you would find in household products. We try to keep it simple here, and the cost of our magnetic soap is already reasonable. It's reasonable enough that it could actually be scaled up. Think that the elements that are contained in this soap are carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, chlorine, and iron, all very, very common elements, and therefore the soap that we've made is cheap, commercially viable.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, and we'll watch to see where your soap shows up, so to speak.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Julian
Easto. It's been a great pleasure, Ira.
You're quite welcome. Julian Easto is a professor in the School of Chemistry at the University of Bristol in the UK.
You've heard of bird watching and whale watching, but wolf watching? Well, it turns out an entire industry of tour companies has cropped up outside of Yellowstone National Park. Montana Public Radio's Dan Boyce got the chance to see and hear a wild wolf pack.
The first hints of light are just starting to brighten the morning sky as Nathan Varley and I head into Yellowstone in his black Suburban. We drive winding, snowy roads through the Black Tail Plateau.
It's a great area to find wolves because it's the habitat for their primary prey in the winter, which is elk and bison.
Varley grew up just outside the park, and it's here where wolves killing livestock and big game have created the passionate controversy around these animals. Varley earned his PhD studying wolves, but academia wasn't a good fit. So about 6 years ago, he started a wildlife tour company called The Wild Side.
We've been adding programs, doing higher volume each year than the year before. thinking this might be a good sighting for us.
We're walking out to a bluff overlooking Slough Creek. Burley directs me to a spotting scope pointing across the valley.
Look through here, you say I can.
Oh, yeah, there's some wolves.
About a dozen, more than a half mile away.
It seems like they've already had their breakfast.
That's Englishman Darren Sanday. He and his wife Beverly are here on their first winter tour of the park.
All the wolves had their heads raised. Some were still laid down. Big grey at the top of the hill, fully extended, head back, thrown back.
And then we hear it.
It's something that you will not hear as a normal day-to-day person.
It's unearthly, it's magical, it's mystical sort of sound.
And it goes through you.
And it seems to bounce off everywhere. So while they're howling, it's like nothing else goes on.
They howl for about 2 minutes. Afterward, we head back to the Suburban. Burley says his typical clients have idealized, romantic notions of wolves. They expect noble creatures that mate for life and kill only what they need.
Well, the reality is they're top carnivores and predators, and they're effective at being that way because they're these very honed, skilled killing machines.
Nathan Varley's not romantic about wolves. He's respectful, both as a scientist and as a businessman. For NPR News, I'm Dan Boyce in Yellowstone National Park.
This is NPR News.
Scientists are reporting that aliens are wiping out the animals in Florida's Everglades. Those aliens are Burmese pythons from Asia. They've been slithering around South Florida for decades, but scientists now say the constrictors are so bad they're eating their way through the swamps. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, the federal government has decided to do something about it.
Michael Dorcas has been catching snakes since he was a kid in Texas. But a 15-foot Burmese python is a handful, or two.
You typically try to grab them behind the head, get somebody else to grab the back end of them, but often still they defecate all over you, even if they can't bite you. So it's always an unpleasant thing when you catch a wild python.
Dorcas is a biologist at Davidson College in North Carolina. For the past 8 years, he's been driving through the Everglades counting animals, specifically mid-sized mammals. Dorcas wanted to know how big a bite the pythons are taking out of the mammal population. When he compared the number of mammals now to the 1990s, when pythons were less common, he was shocked.
Once we calculated the percentages, we had no idea they were going to be this dramatic.
How dramatic?
Let's see, 99.3% decrease in raccoon observations, decreases of 98.9% in possums, 94% in white-tailed deer, 87.5% in bobcats.
Nearly all the raccoons, possums, deer, and bobcats gone. Now, counting animals by sight from a car isn't foolproof, but it is an accepted practice in wildlife research. Dorcas reports his findings in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. He blames pythons because in areas known to be thickest with the snake, the mammals are scarcer. And where there are fewer pythons, there are more mammals. And there's no evidence it's some disease either.
This is the first study to show actual effects on populations. And that's why it's remarkable, and the fact that those effects are extremely severe.
The onset of the python invasion is often blamed on snake owners who release their pets when they get too big for comfort. Lawyer Marshall Myers represents the pet industry. He says maybe, but it's more complicated than that.
I think it's habitat loss. I think it's pythons are obviously some of it.
Myers notes that there's less water now in the Everglades, and that could lower animal populations. But he acknowledges that the python invaders and other exotic animals that escape or are released by owners give the pet trade a bad name.
There are species that are not in this country that we do not want in this country, because if they came in through the pet trade or through the zoos, they could cause a lot of environmental harm. And that's just a big black eye.
The Federal Fish and Wildlife Service has been watching the python explosion and is now taking action. This month, they made it illegal to import these snakes or transport them across state lines. That includes three other constrictor species from Africa and South America. Biologist Susan Jewell at the service studies injurious species that invade the U.S., things like zebra mussels and poisonous lionfish. She says it's possible Florida's pythons could spread if they learn how to survive in colder weather.
I think that it's a good heads up for everybody. This can happen anywhere. And most likely will if these snakes get established.
Jewel says the ban allows people who now own these snakes to keep them, and you can still buy and sell them within a state. She says the new rule does not mean you have to give up your snake. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
We have more All Things Considered coming up right after this.